White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Ladies and gentlemen, and students of the International Jew, it is January 9th already, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager.
And I'm Hadding Scott.
And we have a very good chapter for you tonight. I really mean it. The Dearborn Independent never lets its readers down. That's how I see it. It is consistently fascinating material. This week, chapter 74, What Jews Attempted Where They Had Power. Now, if only the American people had heeded the warning that's given in this chapter, and when it was said, we would be a lot better off today, right, Hattie?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you probably might not know what I'm talking about, but, you know, there was the idea of the way these Jews treated this poor Christian pastor. You know, is quite a good message,
but it seems very typical.
Yeah, it's like typical. Being nice. They're saying, you know, the message I took away from this most is that if you're nice to Jews, they see that as weakness and they're going to take advantage of it. And that's the message that I mean, that we should have heeded the warning of that. We still should. Did you get that from it?
Well, not so much niceness, but if you show some hesitation and a little bit of self-criticism, they'll see that as an opening for attack.
Okay, well, we'll see. Now, this is not one of our longer chapters, so we'll have plenty of time, actually. Maybe not plenty, but we'll have time to comment, so we'll see as we go along what we think of it. So, okay, I turn it over to you.
All right, International Jew, Chapter 74, What Jews Attempted Where They Had Power. The time of the year has come when Christians implore the tolerance of Jews, while Christmas is being celebrated. If the Jews will only permit the Christians to celebrate Christmas in their schools, their homes, their churches, in their city squares and country villages, there will be more disposition on the part of the public to believe the Jewish boasts of tolerance. It is not yet announced whether the Jews will give their permission or not, but that there are inquiries being made into the matter is indicated by this article in the Brooklyn Eagle of October 31st, 1921, I guess.
Yes.
Canon William Sheaf Chase today made public a letter he has sent to the Secretary of the Board of Education asking for a copy of rules and regulations which, he alleged, forbid the telling of a Christ story at Christmas time in the public schools. Canon Chase said that the attention of the Federation of Churches has been called to a statement of a kindergarten teacher who last year said she had told such a story and had been notified that she will be removed from her position if she repeats such an exercise this Christmas. He said that the Supreme Court of the United States has said that this is a Christian country, and the courts in the state of New York have said that Christianity is the common law of our land. Dr. Chase added, "This government has treated the Hebrew more generously than any other nation in the world. I believe that the people generally, Hebrew as well as Christian, are very happy to enter into the spirit of Christmas time. Any attempt, therefore, to eliminate Christ from the hymns of our country, from the reading books, and from the religious holidays of the Christian people, I believe, is not instigated by the Hebrews as a whole, but by certain misguided leaders of Jewish religion.
You know, it's interesting that they call them Hebrews, so that they don't call them Jews. Because we know that people have always been nervous about calling Jews Jews. So at that time, it was very common to call them Hebrews, and the Jews themselves often used that word for themselves.
Yeah, they did.
Yeah.
It was used to be a magazine called the American Hebrew.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a variation of the Christmas theme. Instead of looking forward to Christmas, it is a spirit of inquiry as to how far we can go at Christmas. We are asking whether we dare, as Christians in a Christian land, whisper the name that gives Christmas its meaning. That is, the Christians are doing the Christmas asking early this year. Christian teachers want to know if they will be discharged if they give their classes a bit of Christmas flavor, as all our teachers gave us when we were young. The contrast between the schools which we of the mature generation attended when we were young and the schools of today whose pupils are carefully screened from the fact that Christmas celebrates Christ is such a contrast as ought to give mature Americans a pause. Well, you know, there are people that talk about the war against Christmas. Mm-hmm. If they would make that Jewish connection, then it would all be so much clearer.
Well, also, we do. I mean, everybody in our kind of movement does, but I don't know. Do the other people? Are there? I guess I never thought about it. Are there bunches of people out there, Christian people, who talk about the war against Christmas and they don't know that it's from Jews?
They don't talk about that.
Well, they wouldn't dare. Yeah, who
else
also, would it be from?
I would point out that in Germany, at least in Bavaria, they still have their little bit of Christian indoctrination in their public schools. They still have, you know, a cross on the wall, stuff like this. As a matter of fact, the ruling political party, Bavaria is practically a one-party state, has been since the Second World War. And the one party that rules Bavaria is the Christian Social Union.
Right. Right. I think that's really neat that they're able to have their own party and they affiliate with the other party, Merkel's party. But they didn't get subsumed into it. They have their own. And that says a lot about Bavaria as being. And of course, turns out they're the wealthiest part of Germany, and they're, you know, you'd think that maybe they would be more laid back or something because they're south, but they're quite a powerhouse in Bavaria, so they demand respect, and they get what they get a certain amount of what they want.
But if past experience be the standard of judgment, the appeal to Jewish tolerance in New York will be futile. If Christians do not take their rights, it is certain the Jews will never grant them. It would be un-Jewish to do so. And the ceaseless cry of the leaders is, be Jewish! Any number of instances could be cited of the whip which Jewish leaders crack across the educational and political systems of the city of New York. But one or two must serve for the present.
You know, I just thought when I read this that it's true that all this stuff was going on in New York and around New York and in the East. It was not necessarily as typical of the rest of the nation in 1921. But, you know, the Jews had all this power in New York, and so they were wielding it. But now they have it everywhere, so we see how that's, you know, moved to the rest of the nation.
The first case to be considered is that of Reverend William Carter, Doctor of Divinity, given in Who's Who in America as pastor of the Throop Avenue Presbyterian Church, Brooklyn, author of The Gate of Janus, an epic story of the war, also of Milton and His Masterpiece, and Studies in the Pentateuch. He is an extensive traveler and a lecturer of reputation, his specialty being history and literature. At an important YMCA center, he has lectured for 30 consecutive weeks a year on current events, which of course was so successful
Which course was so successful
that he was asked by the New York Board of Education to start a similar one at the Erasmus High School. For 10 years, he has been engaged by the New York Board of Education as special lecturer in the popular evening extension courses. The course Dr. Carter undertook was badly run down, but in 6 weeks, the regular audience had been increased from 35 to 350. The plan of the lectures was to discuss a major topic selected by the board. A second period was devoted to the discussion of current events, and a third period to questions from the audience. Now it happened that for the week of November 15th, 1920, just a year ago, the topic selected by the Board of Education was The Racial Origins of the American People, a study of immigration. That is to say, Dr. Carter was asked to study that matter and discuss it publicly before his weekly lecture audience at Erasmus School. He did so, taking time to make a serious investigation of all phases of the subject. He showed that just before the war, 30 days before the war, the highest peak of immigration was reached. The year ending June 30th, 1914, having seen 1,403,000 aliens enter this country. Analyzing this great flood, he showed that whereas 6% came from Great Britain and 2% came from Scandinavian countries, over 10% were Jews. The doctor's subject was the racial origins of the American people. Again, on the subject, what has immigration done for America? This subject also scheduled by the Board of Education.
Boy, can you imagine they would never do that now, would they?
Well,
or
sure.
Would they if you spun it as how good this immigration is? And
the benefits of immigration for America.
Yeah, something like that.
But don't you talk about anything else.
Yeah.
This subject also scheduled by the Board of Education. Dr. Carter showed that some parts of Europe had given their worst instead of their best, and stated that the lowest percentage of immigration came from the best developed and most desirable countries, while the largest percentage came from the least desirable. For example, he differentiated between the desirable Italians and those who form the material for black hand activities. Speaking of Russia and Austro-Hungary, he made a reference to the Jews. But Dr. Carter made a mistake, perhaps two. It is always difficult to tell just where the line falls between fear of giving offense and fear of being unfair. In any event, Dr. Carter gave every evidence of, let us say, fear of being unfair. But it is fear. And a Jew scents fear long away. A long way. Yeah. The man who fears, even though he fears to be unfair, is already marked by the Jew who may happen to be stationed to watch him.
Well, that sounds threatening, doesn't it? Jews are watching.
That's an interesting question there, whether Jewish organizations, organized Jewry, deliberately sends out Jews to monitor things that are going on. I think they do.
Yeah, I bet. It makes so much sense. So whatever this man was speaking, there was a particular Jew who could, you know, analyze it, who was sent out to listen to him. See what he said. I'm sure that's true. That's interesting, isn't it?
I was at a militia meeting once, and I'd heard about it on the radio, mm-hmm. and it was an AM radio station that would let people do their own amateur radio shows on the weekend, and several of those shows were sort of patriot militia oriented shows, and they promoted this organizational meeting for the local militia. This was back during the militia craze.
Mm-hmm.
And there were.
And that was, that was like in the 80s?
90s.
90s, right.
Yeah.
90s.
And there probably were a couple hundred people, it turned out. It was a meeting in a public library, in a room at a public library.
Mm-hmm.
And there was this one really angry looking Jew there.
Oh,
really angry looking. And I had not driven to the meeting. I had walked. And as I was walking home, I see this Jew drive past me with this real angry look at his face. He's looking at me. I think he was there taking down tag numbers and trying to just get whatever information he could.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, not surprising at all.
He obviously wasn't there as a friend anyway.
No, he wasn't interested in joining the militia.
No. Well, I wasn't really interested either, but I went there just to see what they were doing. So Dr. Carter, to avoid giving offense by this part of his lecture, did the usual thing which has always drawn sneers from the Jewish press. He began to pay compliments to the Jews on their good points. He spoke of their contributions to art, science, and philosophy, to statesmanship, religion, and philanthropy. He lauded their distinguished men by name, such as Disraeli, Rubinstein, Schiff, Kahn, even Rabbi Wise.
Schiff. Huh.
He referred to his pride in counting many Jews among his personal friends.
Yeah.
With all respect to Dr. Carter, it was the same old stuff usually handed out in such circumstances. Madison C. Peters made it unjustly famous, and American clergymen have been spouting it ever since. Madison C. Peters.
You know who that is?
No. I was going to look it up, but I forgot.
Yeah.
Obviously, some guy that really...
While you're reading, I'm gonna look it up.
All right. If Dr. Carter will study the alleged contributions of the Jews to the arts and sciences, study this as carefully as he did the immigration theme, he may omit the praises from future lectures. And he may also revise his list of great Jews. But that is neither here nor there. As we have found bad elements in these other peoples, said Dr. Carter in this portion of his lecture, so they are to be found in the Jew. And as the majority of these 143,000 Jews who came here the year before the war were from Russia or Russian countries, let us not forget that the Jews themselves admit the Russian Jew is the worst of his race. Apparently,
Well, finish that part, and then I'll tell you about Peter.
Apparently, the audience remained unshocked. The question period came round, and two Jews, a woman and a man, asked the lecturer why he had picked out the Russian Jew in particular for criticism. Dr. Carter replied that he had only given the evidence of the Jews themselves, that he was merely quoting what the Jews themselves had alleged time and again, to explain certain matters. He added that the statement was universally accepted, except by some who came from Russia.
Well, this goes on and on now, so I'll just stick in here and then you can kind of pick that up. Madison Peters was just kind of a guy like this fellow here, Carter. He was a noted minister, author, and lecturer. He died. I don't have a date on this. He died of influenza. This is his obituary. His many books. Oh, here we go. His many books include Justice to the Jew and The Jew as a Patriot. So there he was, one of those Jewish apologists, you know, Christian minister. He headed the Bloomingdale Reformed Church somewhere. I think this is New York City. And later became a Baptist. Probably a Christian Zionist. Anyway, so that's what we're dealing with. A Christian minister who lectures and so on and writes books and is very Jew-friendly. Or you might say obsequious.
All right.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Well, the question I want to know is, was his wife Jewish?
I don't know.
Did Jews buy a lot of his books? How did the Jews reward him?
Well, what I came upon was a New York Times thing, and it only gave me the first paragraph, and then didn't give me any more, so I can't answer the rest about his life at the moment.
A few days afterward, the Board of Education sent word to Dr. Carter that complaints had been received against him for certain statements against the Jews, and calling upon him to explain. Dr. Carter is said to have replied that as only 2 Jews out of 400 people had objected at the lecture, he regarded that as evidence that the proprieties had not been violated. Within a week, however, a more insistent communication was sent out by the Board of Education, stating that more letters of complaint had been received, and citing Dr. Carter to meet his accusers at a special meeting of investigation. Now begins as strange a proceeding as American people may hope to see in this land of the free. It is really not as rare as some might think. It can be duplicated in a number of known and proved cases. The way the Carter case worked out was this. Dr. Carter arrived as summoned. There were 7 Jews there before him. 4 of these Jews admitted they had not attended the lecture, and one had never even heard of Dr. Carter before. The minister was alone, not knowing what was afoot, and not having been told to bring witnesses who had heard his lecture, he was there, a lone Gentile before a Jewish tribunal. The Jewish delegation was headed by a certain Rabbi C.H. Levy, who was referred to as a secretary of the Board of Jewish Ministers, a union of rabbis in connection with the New York Kehillah, which is part of the general spy system of American Jewry. Rabbi Levy admitted that he had not attended the specific lecture complained of, nor any other lecture in the course, but declared he was there to represent my people. Well, Rabbi Levy's people were pretty well represented. There was hardly any other kind of people there except the Christian clergyman, who was on trial for telling the truth as to public opinion, and Jewish opinion particularly, about the Russian Jew. So the inquisition upon the Gentile began. 6 letters were read, most of them having been addressed to Dr. W. L. Ettinger, superintendent of New York schools. One of these letters asked Dr. Ettinger, as a Jew, not to allow his people to be maligned and misrepresented, but to see that this Gentile was stopped.
Yeah, and let's make it clear that Dr. Ettinger was not a Jew, I'm sure, they say, ask Dr. Edinger as a Jew, but that as a Jew refers to the letter writer.
I wouldn't be so sure.
Not to let his, well, okay, you know, I was reading it that way because I figured
I think Edinger probably
German
is.
Name. Maybe so. Oh, isn't that horrible? Yuck. This poor guy.
And they're saying, you've got, where's your loyalty to your people?
Yeah. I'm glad I brought that up. I believe you're right. You know, this makes me think of Christ before the tribunal of the, when they found him guilty. And so just very much, you know, where you're, there you are brought up before all these people who are out to get you. And without any warning, so you don't know, I mean, like this poor man didn't bring anybody with him.
After the reading of the letters, Dr. Carter was permitted to speak. He called attention to the similarity of the style in all the letters, a similarity which suggested to him the possibility of their having been dictated by one person. At which Rabbi Levy flew into a passion, though no one had mentioned his name. Dr. Carter also observed that as Dr. Ettinger had been appealed to on racial, religious, and prejudiced grounds, it would be right to permit Dr. Carter time to get witnesses on his side. This was not permitted. He was on trial.
So who didn't permit this? Ettinger? Or Ettinger had been appealed to. It would be right to permit. But who made that ruling? Ettinger? That he couldn't go and, they couldn't put it off while he got some witnesses. Anyway. This Ettinger does not sound like a friend, does he?
A logical thing to do would have been to get some people to talk to Dr. Ettinger, but, well, there are Jews like that that are fence straddlers, you know, I think. And, mm-hmm. you know, the other Jews can put pressure on them much more effectively than the non-Jews can, I think.
Yeah.
Even the Jews admitted under straight questioning that what Dr. Carter had said was not uttered invidiously. They admitted that he had referred to the undesirable elements of other races as well as of the Jews. It was admitted that the subject was not of his own choosing, but was assigned to him by the Board of Education. There was very little left at the end of the examination, except to assume that the Jews were a sacrosanct race, with special privileges, a race whom no non-Jew should presume even to mention, in anything but awe-filled tones. That was the issue as it appeared that day, with half the Jewish population of the United States centered in the city of New York. They had assumed control of American education at its source. The group of Jews sitting in judgment on Dr. Carter were as serene in their control of the education of the Christians as if they had been a Soviet court sitting in Moscow. That's an interesting statement. The group of Jews sitting in judgment on Dr. Carter were as serene in their control of the education of the Christians as if they had been a Soviet court sitting in Moscow.
That really is. Yeah, you know, so they knew their power. They were confident of their power, that they were in control, right? Isn't that right? Yeah.
They had succeeded in driving everything Christian out of the schools. They had succeeded in introducing the most sickening praise of their own race. They looked forward to the teaching of Judaism as the universal morality. Mm. It was further brought out that this Christian minister had been one of the men who had preached in favor of the Jews. He had been one of those public men on whom Jewish leaders could depend to respond with typical Christian generosity. He had delivered blows at racial prejudice. He had lauded the Jewish race and its leading figures. He had interpreted its commanding influence as the reward of diligence and ability. He had thundered against what Jewish reports had led him to believe was the crime at Kishinev. And for this, he had been duly complimented by the Jewish Publication Society and others. But he had now spoken a word of truth which the Jews disliked. And he was before them for trial and condemnation.
Well, do you want to bring up here the crime of Kishinev?
I didn't look it up.
Oh, well, that's that place in Russia where they had a pogrom, and they made a big deal out of it. I don't remember all the details right now, but I do know that it was a big issue. I mean, it was a big issue in the United States because the Jews made it a big issue. And this is one of the things why they all had to come. They all had to leave Russia because, you know, there was all this intolerance against them and violence against them. This is involved in the, you know, the millions of Jews who are going to be killed in Russia and so on. They had to be allowed into the United States. So it was one of the most... There was a bigger pogrom than this one, but this was a big one and a well-known one. So that's what they're referring to here. Oh, when you think about all that stuff that they got away with, it's just terrible. That really wasn't that bad. It was vastly, the numbers were vastly exaggerated as to victims of
probably
that so-called pogrom, yeah.
Yeah, those kinds of things are usually exaggerated. If somebody's trying to get you to take action based on some event, there's an incentive to exaggerate.
Right.
And Jews always will. In the course of the examination, it developed that he had been a citizen of the United States for 30 years. This is Dr. Carter. Having come to this country from England at the age of 15, Rabbi Levy apparently missed the full fact, getting only the fact that Dr. Carter was born in England. May I inquire as to whether the gentleman is or is not a citizen of the United States? Said the rabbi in the air of one who was innocently uncovering a great exposure. I became a citizen over 30 years ago, as soon as the law allowed, as I trust you did, was Dr. Carter's straight thrust. The rabbi dropped the subject. He did not take up the challenge as to his own citizenship. But that the matter burned in him is evidenced by his later remark. I'll see to it, notwithstanding all this, that you shall never speak again from any platform in New York, you dirty Englishman.
Now, he said that in that meeting. That's what it sounds like. His later remark, for what they say later, isn't that something to say that in a meeting like that?
Dr. Carter called the attention of the committee to the hatred and the malignity expressed in the face, attitude, and words of the enraged rabbi, and said he did not know whether it was a threat against his life, his pastorate, or his position as lecturer for the New York Board of Education. The term dirty is rather an unusual one to apply to a race that has so long astonished Semitic countries by its insistence on its bath. That is to say, the accuracy of Rabbi Levy's description would draw about the same degree as would an appraisal of his gentlemanliness.
Well, what is this bath?
I must have a bath. I'm getting a bit smelly.
Yeah, so to apply to a race means the English race. And so it's astonished the Semitic countries by its insistence on cleanliness and having its bath, yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it.
Right. There was, fortunately, one other non-Jew present, namely Ernest L. Crandall, supervisor of lectures, who was American enough to enter the fray. I thought there weren't any non-Jews present. I thought it was just...
Well, there was none. Well, there had to be the authorities there. There was the first guy, Ettinger, and then I guess this guy was Robert. He's the head of the lecture series. So they were there. But Carter didn't have anybody on his side, standing with him.
Okay. Ernest L. Crandall, supervisor of lectures, who was American enough to enter the fray. He addressed the hysterical little rabbi. I have never seen nor heard such bitterness and hatred expressed by any human being toward another as you have manifested here. You ought to be ashamed of yourself, and if I hear another word from you along such lines, I will have you thrown out. The future of Mr. Crandall should be worth watching. If he is apologetic for his principles, they will get him. If not, he may be the instrument of getting some things that are wrong with New York. At any rate, Mr. Crandall acquitted Dr. Carter, and the Jews went out muttering. It is rather an unusual and noteworthy fact, the acquittal of a man against whom the Jews had moved the charge and against whom the secretary of the Board of Jewish Ministers had uttered the aforesaid threat. Dr. Carter went back to Erasmus School. He received from the Board of Education his appointments for the ensuing months. Affairs seemed to be going along as before. Then, one day, all the lecturers on current events in New York public schools received simultaneous notice that they must refrain from discussing the Jewish and Irish questions. With Zionism crowding the newspapers and breeding a war in Mesopotamia, which is Iraq, and dictating the policy of the diplomatic departments of Great Britain and the United States, nothing new there, nothing old there, I should say, they still do that, as well noted by, professors Walt and Mearsheimer at Harvard and Chicago. With the Irish question uppermost in the minds of millions and coloring the politics of the United States as well as challenging the full ability of the British government, that is, with the two foremost current events seething throughout the world, orders were given through the New York Board of Education that lecturers must remain mum. It was plain to be seen what had happened. Rabbi Levy and those who worked with him, having failed in their personal attack, had achieved what they wanted another way, by an order given to the lecturers not to speak about the Jewish or Irish question. Why lug in the Irish? The Irish were not protesting against discussion of the Irish question. The Irish wanted the Irish question discussed. They believed that the successful issue of the matter depended on wide and free discussion. It is beyond the realm of imagination that the Irish should ever ask, desire, or sanction a gag on popular discussion of Irish affairs. This was, of course, shortly before Ireland got its independence, I assume. It was around that time, and it was largely as a result of pressure from the United States.
The United States was pressuring to give Ireland its independence.
Yes. Yes. As to Dr. Carter, his audiences had been asking him questions about the Irish question for 3 years. In YMCA, in public school, in People's Forum, everywhere, he had been asked for information about one or another phase of the Irish question. And being a well-informed man, he was able to give answers. And no one had ever complained before. Indeed, it is said that at the next lecture he gave at Erasmus School, following the encounter with Rabbi Levy, the audience had asked questions touching the Irish question, and Mr. Crandall was present and found no ground for criticism. Yet, soon thereafter, came the order to observe complete silence on the Irish question. Why? Even the tyro in Jewish policy knows the answer. The Irish question was lugged in to camouflage the order regarding the Jewish question. That is a very common Jewish practice. Any Gentile name will serve for concealment. And what you see today, of course, you'll see things like a coalition of the oppressed. They'll get all these minority groups to have at least nominal participation in some agenda of theirs, so that it isn't obviously a Jewish agenda. That's the purpose of it. They've got the blacks. Well, they tried to drag the Irish into it. I don't know whether Irish actually endorsed that participation, but they got blacks involved in it. They've gotten other minority groups involved. You know, I mean, they love to see the Jews are very heavily involved in promoting non-white immigration because it increases their coalition of allies against the white people.
Yeah, they even get Arabs and Muslims to join them in some of these things.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Imagine, and homosexuals too. They get homosexuals.
Oh, yeah.
Matter of fact, that this thing with Dr. Carter there reminded me of something that a friend of mine pointed out to me just yesterday about the German American economist Hans Hermann Hoppe gave some talk at a university in I think it was University of Nevada, Las Vegas, where he made an offhand comment about homosexuals not being very thrifty. Because they don't have to be thrifty because they don't have families and they're not saving up for a family, you know, to support them and all this stuff and put them through school or whatever. And he got complaints just very much like the complaints that are discussed here against Carter. But Hoppe got the ACLU on his side. Imagine an Irishman and his family attending an evening lecture on current events and asking a question about the Irish situation. Imagine the lecturer saying, "I am forbidden to mention Ireland or the Irish question on these premises." The Irishman, being a white man, would not be slow to see that somehow he was being discriminated against. He would demand to be told why the lecturer dared not mention the matter. And being forbidden to mention the Jews either, the lecturer would not be able to say, "Those Jews down at the Board of Education have put their taboo on both the Jews and the Irish." He would be breaking the rules even in giving that explanation. But imagine the Irishman being classed with the Jew. The Irishman who wants publicity with the Jew who fears it. How long would it take an Irishman to see that what was intended to be discrimination in favor of the Jew was discrimination against the Irish? Yet that was precisely what the Jews of New York brought about in the public lectures, in the public lecture system, to make their point against a Christian clergyman who had told a very well-known truth about the Jews. Of course, there is nothing in such an order that would appear to the Jew as being subversive. Suppression is his first thought. Suppress the paper! Suppress the investigation! Suppress the out-and-out speaker! Suppress the immigration discussion! Suppress the facts about the theater! About the money system, about the baseball scandal, about the bootlegging business. Suppress the lecturers of the city of New York. fire them from their jobs unless they stand up like phonographs and recite what men like the Sentinel rabbis of New York dictate. The order was Jewish in every element of it, and as an American citizen who did not believe that American free speech should be the plaything of a crowd of aliens, Dr. Carter resigned his lectureship. It means serious inconvenience and financial loss to him to do so at the end of December, when it was late to make further plans for the winter. But a principle was at stake, and he resigned. Immediately, the matter came into the newspapers, and there was the usual ado. The Jewish writers throwing threats about recklessly, a few timid Americans asking what New York was coming to. One newspaper came out with an American editorial defending the right of free speech, but changed its tone somewhat upon receiving a deluge of Jewish protests threatening the paper with the displeasure of the Jews. A man of less ability and of lower standing than Dr. Carter might have been overwhelmed by the storm, but he had at last struck rock, and there he stood. At that time, he was not known to have said anything detrimental to the Jews, and he is not known to have made subsequent remarks upon his experience. That is, being attacked by the Jews, he is not known to have attacked them in return. It is quite possible that he might be induced to do the Madison C. Peters stunt again and speak in praise of them, giving them the usual laudation which they themselves first prepared for our consumption. But nonetheless, he has been, through no fault of his own, the focus of the vindictive policy which pursues the truth-teller. It may be distasteful to Dr. Carter to have his story thus told, but if he will begin anew his studies in the history and character of the international Jew, he will find his own experience a valuable commentary thereon. Dr. Carter is only one of many. There are teachers in New York who could a tale unfold that would stir indignation to its depths. But there has never been anyone to tell their story or take their side. Many of these stories are in the possession of the Dearborn Independent. And that was the issue of November 19th, 1921.
Very good one. Don't you think that's a powerful one?
It sounds like something that has happened over and over and over. I mean, the Jewish behavior that he describes there is like things that I've experienced myself.
Well, right. We know this is the way they do things, but this was very well told. The vindictive policy which pursues the truth-teller. You know, that happens to all truth tellers, even if it's not Jews doing it. Truth tellers have to say a lot of things that make people unhappy. And
that's
then,
right. Well, truth teller always implies telling truth that a lot of people don't know or that is suppressed, right? That's what
right.
that implies.
Yeah. Well, that's right. And this, you know, I've got something. One thing I'll say here is that, you know, during I was looking up this Rabbi Levy before the program, and you know, I just came upon all these Jewish newspapers, and you know what, of that you never heard of, you know, of the things that, but they're online there. And well, I was looking for information about him, and there's just these little bits and pieces. So I'd click on there, and then it'd be this Jewish newspaper, and somewhere in there, and all in this small type of ads and news, little stories, there was something about him, but I never, you know, studied at all to find it. But, I mean, it just struck me how many of these things there were and are where they, you know, it's all Jews. and the ads are probably all by Jews and for Jews, and you know, do your business with these people, and they're from cities and so on. You know, from I think I found what I don't know what cities they were in, but every city has them, and they're just all over the place. You think of the amount of togetherness that's created for these Jews to reach Jews and just talk about Jews and talk about what this Jew's doing, what that Jew's doing, all these little news items. But I mean, nothing is too small or minor to go into these things. And it just struck me as to how they stick together that way by doing that. I don't think we could do it. I mean, we just wouldn't like it. I've thought, well, we should have these organizations. We should be real tight together, but I don't know. You know, what do you think about that? But that's what they do, and that's the secret of their success, I think.
Well, yeah, they're very oriented toward groupthink, you could say.
Yeah.
It seems as if one Jew says something, the rest of the Jews tend to repeat it, whatever it is. They or if you get a few Jews saying something, the rest of the Jews just assume that it must be true, right? And I think, you know, maybe some of them exploit that, you know, deliberately. And so you get all this Holocaust crap, right? Some Jew will make up some story, and the rest of the Jews will say, you see, it's true with the Holocaust, oh boy. You know,
Well, it's based on the fact that they feel persecuted, that they're always taught, like this Kishinev pogrom, so they're always taught that they're under attack, that they're hated, which basically they are, but they're hated, and so therefore they have to stick together like this, and that gives them the motivation to do it, and maybe to subscribe to these papers even if they don't want to read it, you know, and keep all this stuff going, and that makes this tight connection that they have. That's what ought to be broken. That would be outlawed, not be able to do that. But I, you know, in a free democracy, you can't do that.
Well, contrast that Jewish groupthink with what Adolf Hitler called the Germanic Objektivitätsfimmel, mania for objectivity, right?
Yeah.
Our people, see, while the Jews highly praise, at least, you know, there's a certain kind of Jew that highly praises the Jew that is as ethnocentric as possible, right? You know, like this Baruch Goldstein that went into the mosque in Palestine and shot a bunch of Palestinians while they were praying. Mm-hmm. There are Jews over there that you know, will lay tributes at his grave and say he was a wonderful man, he did the best thing, he was a hero. You wouldn't see that happening in a European country, you know. I mean, I could give the example of George Armstrong Custer. I mean, he's not there's no segment of the white population that I know that goes to the grave of General George Armstrong Custer and lays gifts or pays tribute, you know, to his memory. Although I'm open to the possibility that he's been misrepresented, but what we regard as a fine example of our race or of anybody is somebody that is able to be objective, that is open to seeing the other side of any question and understanding it. But that's not the Jewish ideal.
No. And that's all based on the fact that they believe, because they've been told it since day one, that they're hated by others, that they're special. God allows them to suffer because they're his chosen people and all these kind of things, even if they're not religious. But, you know, that somehow they need to do this, and that's why they keep doing it. And of course, the people say, well, all these Jews are okay. It's these leaders that keep doing this to them. Well, yeah, the leaders do keep doing it, but they keep falling for it or accepting it, too. So
That's right.
So therefore, yeah, they can say that a person, a Jew who goes out and kills innocent Palestinians, they say, oh, these Palestinians aren't innocent. They want to destroy us. So he's a hero. And for some reason, this makes them more powerful. I mean, you can look at this and say, well, nobody would want to copy that kind of thinking and behavior. But look how powerful they are. It's a conundrum.
Yeah.
I mean, it bothers me that we don't find a solution to this. We're not like them. We don't want to be like them. But they keep getting the better of things.
I noticed a couple of things in this article where it talked about how the Supreme Court had said that the United States were a Christian nation, and that the New York legislature had said that that Christianity was the law of the land. I think that's what it said. That's something I've heard from identity preachers like Pete Peters. They used to say that all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You think, you know, that's true, or what?
It's one of those things that's fallen down the memory hole.
Oh.
Yeah, not that I'm particularly, in favor of boosting Christianity myself, but, I do think it's wrong that it should be attacked and undermined by an ethnic minority, and that people are left, morally adrift without any social network because of the actions of this minority.
That's how they can do that. And we allow it out of this nice, I call it niceness, but out of this feeling that we must see, as you said, see both sides and see their good side and praise their great men, who are none of them were great, but shifty, sneaky men, and point out their successes and, be fair in all these ways. This is such a big mistake because, we just need to see him as an enemy. If you don't see these people as an enemy.
I don't think that seeing both sides of any question is a mistake. I think, the Germans really led the world in that. In the 19th century, the Germans led the world in studying other cultures. But they didn't allow that. In the long run, they didn't allow that to make them put their interest aside. You see, there's a difference between making sure that you understand the other side's point of view and abandoning your own interest. I mean,
They never did. They're always very, very firm about caring about Germans and the German race and so on. See, we don't have that. We certainly don't have it in the United States.
Well, it takes a certain strength to understand the other side's point of view without abandoning your own. There's a certain strength there that's required for that. Unfortunately, a lot of people don't have it.
No, or maybe we don't even understand it. Okay, well, looks like the show is over. Oh, no, was that 30 or was that 10? Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thanks for listening to this program. And now it's 10 minutes, 10 seconds. And we will, of course, be back next week. So, good night, Hattie.
All right.
Okay, good night, everybody.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.